All week, we've had conversations about the current heroin and painkiller epidemics and the shift towards treating them as a health issue, not a crime. Is that evolution or racism? This current scourge largely affects white Americans and the suburbs. The heroin and crack epidemics of the 60s and 80s largely affected poor inner-city blacks. Mark Maurer is executive director of the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit that works for sentencing reform. We'll speak with him in a minute. But first, former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke. In 1988, he shocked people by coming out in favor of treating addiction as a health crisis and decriminalizing the use of drugs. Mayor Schmoke, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Do you feel vindicated now on what we're seeing as a shift from treating heroin use as a crime to a health problem?
Well, I see signs that national policy and policy at the state level is moving in that direction. I'm not sure yet whether we've really gotten to the point that I could say we're where I'd like it to be, but we sure have made a very positive change. But I do still see signs of class differences and race differences in the way we are approaching it. And hopefully those differences can be eliminated in the next few years.
Well, Mark Maurer, let's get you in here. Again, you're with the Sentencing Project. They look at sentencing reform. And so is the Obama administration, the Justice Department, looking at releasing people who were incarcerated for low-level drug crimes. Your sense of the shift that's happening now?
Well, it's an encouraging shift. You know, we've had this war on drugs for nearly 30 years now. We have record numbers of people incarcerated for a drug offense. We're beginning to see more of a substantial shift right now. I think every American family has someone close to them who has an alcohol or drug problem. People can understand that. So we're beginning to see more use of drug courts, drug treatment instead of prison. The problem is we've sort of institutionalized this whole prison and mandatory sentencing apparatus so heavily, it's very hard to untangle that at this point.
Well, do you agree with Michelle Alexander? She wrote The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, a real flashpoint book. And she argued that the crackdown on drug use during the Nixon administration was really a new form of segregation, that once you label somebody a felon for drug use, they can't get jobs, they can't get housing, they can't vote, they can't get schooling, food stamps. And so it was just another way of reinstituting Jim Crow.
Well, you know, we could debate whether or not this was an intention of the strategy that was developed. Clearly, I think what happened is that as we've had various drug epidemics, our vision of how to respond has been very dependent on the racial perception of the drug user or the drug seller. And when that person, when that image is one of an African-American person, then our responses become very punitive. And all of the consequences Michelle Alexander lays out very much come into play at that point.
Yeah, well, Mayor Schmoke, Jeffrey Fagan, Columbia University professor, is one of those who says that it was over the top, the reaction to the drug use by blacks in the 80s, that it was, demonizing blacks by giving them almost mythical powers when they used drugs. They were super predators, for instance.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, it goes back to the earliest stages of the drug war, which Mark has commented on years ago. I mean, this started not just during the Nixon administration, but way back in the early part of the 20th century when drug laws started to be changed from health regulatory laws to these punitive prohibition laws. Some of it was a focus on opium, which in the West Coast was related to, you know, Asian immigrants. So they were talking about, you know, people of color, just different color at that time. And then, of course, in the middle part of the century, it became demon marijuana, that demon weed that was associated primarily with African Americans in popular culture. And then later on, of course, in the latter part of the 20th century, when we started getting all these mandatory minimums and this high incarceration, the drug problem really was viewed in, I guess, the popular culture as primarily a problem among people of color. That was just throughout the century and even today, it's absolutely incorrect. I mean, in terms of the number of drug abusers, the numbers certainly are disproportionately non-people of color, but the perception is that it is.
Isn't it true, though, that your city, Baltimore, and other inner cities were being ravaged by drugs?
Yes, that then led to serious problems for us in the big cities when we saw a lot more resources going towards prisons and incarceration rather than treatment and public health.
But I guess how much of it was myth? We were told, and people could feel anecdotally, that there were more home robberies, there were more break-ins because people were desperate for money to pay for the drugs. Wasn't that also true? And didn't you need arrests to at least tamp that down?
Well, the problem is it was policy, national policy, that created that environment. I mean, if you just think about the analogy of back in the 20s when we tried to make it an alcohol-free America, you saw crime rates go up. And so you could say, wait a minute, we have this huge spike in crime in our cities back in the 1920s. Why? Well, it was policy. It was policy that made alcohol sale and distribution profitable, and people went to war over those profits. Similarly, in the cities in the 1980s and 90s, what we saw on the street was not people taking drugs and going crazy. We saw wars over territory, distribution rights, and those battles occurred in the inner city. Crime rates went up. For us, we had a dramatic increase in the number of homicides. But again, it wasn't because of the substance itself. It was how we regulated it. So now that we are instituting policies that try to take the profit out of distributing drugs at the street level, I believe you'll start to see a decrease in crime.
I guess, Mark, as someone who's tracked this, I want to ask you first and then Mayor Schmoke. What do you think now, after decades of working on this, when you see articles, a Utah paper writes about a young blonde cheerleader in Utah who fell into the grip of heroin? And the words that they use, she wasn't a shivering urban junkie. To make clear what? What do you think is being made clear there when people try to underscore that these are whites and not inner city blacks?
Well, it's that, you know, some people's children, society, get a second chance in life. They get to make mistakes, and other people's kids don't. And, you know, I think this is not always nor necessarily a conscious strategy or idea. I think much of this is sort of unconscious racism, how we think of things. You know, most people have more compassion for people who look and feel like themselves and live in their same neighborhoods. So people who are describing these things, when they see this young, attractive suburban girl caught up in a drug problem, they're more likely to reach out. They're more likely to be sympathetic. So is that sympathy good? Of course it is, you know, but how do we get over those lines of race and class and recognize that the child of someone else who may be a different race, social class, they are going through virtually the same problem? And it's really distressing after all these decades, we're still viewing things in that way.
I'd like to follow up on that. I listened to an interview recently, the governor of Oklahoma, and she was talking about the heroin problem, and she made a distinction between the people next door as opposed to those who are trying to break into your house next door. And it was as though she's saying that those who had the heroin addiction and were led to, you know, a life of crime should be treated very differently than the person next door. But the bottom line is that if we really extended treatment early and a lot of prevention activities early, we wouldn't have to worry about the problem of either one of them. And that's what we're hoping that will happen in terms of national policy.
As much as you applaud the changes that are happening, there can't help but be some sadness about the young people who were lost.
Well, for me, certainly, you know, I was mayor for 12 years, and unfortunately, 10 of the 12 years that I was mayor, we had 300 or more homicides in our city each year. And unfortunately, the bulk of those homicides were because of warring factions in the war on drugs. And I just knew that if we had policies to take the profit out of distributing drugs at the street level, we could have saved many, many lives.
Well, trickier question to you. Do you think if you'd been listened to in the 1980s, maybe people's children in white suburbia would not be as victimized as they are now by heroin and opiate abuse.
Yeah, I really do think that we would not have seen the spread of this problem if we had intervened early with major public health strategies and not made this appear that it was kind of an us against them. Those people have the drug problem. We don't. I do believe that we would have prevented this incredible spread of the heroin problem throughout the country.
That's Kurt Schmoke, now president of the University of Baltimore, but former mayor of the city. And we've also been speaking to Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project. They back sentencing reform. Also his book, Race to Incarcerate. Mark, Mayor Schmoke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And all of our stories on the opioid epidemic this week are at hereandnow.org, along with many comments, many of you weighing in. And we'd love to hear from you if you haven't yet. And the problem continues. So will our coverage.